Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP Section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guest.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Bob Keebler, and I'm here to talk about the final 199A qualified business deduction and the final regulations. On Friday, January 18, 2019, the U.S. Treasury and Internal Revenue Service issued final regulations pursuant to Section 199 Cap A, along with a new set of proposed regulations and Notice 2019-07. So today we'll talk about this. We'll go through a big picture overview. This will take about 15 to 20 minutes. And first, let's jump in. What exactly happened? Well, the service issued Notice 2019-07. That's the first thing that happened. And that deals with a new trader business aggregation. Then they issued Revenue Proc 2019-11, which deals with wages, followed by the final 199 Cap A regulations, followed by new proposed 199 Cap A regulations. Now, there's some immediate things that we need to bring to your attention. First of all, how you compute the threshold amount for trust has changed greatly. Under the prior regulations, you computed that before taking into account D&I distributions to beneficiaries. Now you compute that afterwards. The main impact that's going to have is between now and March 6th, you may want to make distributions within the 65-day rule to beneficiaries. And the beauty of that is that now you would be able to measure the trust level for 199 Cap A without having to do wage and capital computations. They also explained in great detail the netting rules when you're not aggregating and how if an operation or a trade or business loses money, you have to allocate that loss pro rata across the businesses that are making money. What I'm very quickly figuring out is for clients that are losing money in one business, I want to eliminate that loss within the four corners of the law. And maybe that means not taking bonus or 179 for that particular entity. This becomes very important because when you have to net like that, you're reducing your QBI from the other businesses. However, you're also losing all the attributes for wage and capital testing from that entity. Now, they also went into great detail on trade or business aggregation, and that is in Notice 2019-07. We'll talk about that. Then we'll talk about something different that we've had for over a year now. That's operational aggregation, including the ability to use operational aggregation for relevant pass-through entities. Finally, in a very good change, the service is going to allow taxpayers to use the basis increase associated with a 754 election to compute UBIA. And the beauty of that is then I can use my 754 assets for purposes of the 2.5% test. So that becomes a very important thing. So keep in mind, this deduction is equal to 20% of qualified business income, pass-through entities, including real estate, if the real estate rises to the level of a trade or business. The Notice 2019-7 makes very clear that a net lease is going to not rise to the level of a trade or business. We also have a lot more definitions in the area of specified service trades or businesses. They expanded some of the defining of each profession, and we were definitely limited by the business owner's taxable income. On page 4, if you remember, sole proprietorships, real estate interests, trusts and estates, S corporations, and partnerships can all get the deduction, but the computation differs. So nothing really changed there at a substantive level. They did change the D&I rule with trusts and estates, and now if you make a distribution, that distribution reduces your income and then you do the threshold testing after that. The important thing to remember is that for 2018, if your income was over the threshold amount and you're not a specified service trader business, then you have to start doing wage and capital testing. The regulations also bring out that capital gains includes dividends. Now, that's very important because if I have a business where I'm trying to get my QBI deduction, and at the same time, I have a large portfolio that's throwing off a lot of qualified dividends, I may want to drop that large portfolio into a NING or some other non-grantor trust to get that dividend income off of my income statement, off of my 1040. The final regulations, again, allow us to use the adjustment to UBIA that's associated with the 754 election. I think that's very important because that was something I was very worried about. We spent a lot of time on that issue and what to do about it, so that seems to have gone away. In the area of specified service trades or businesses, a little bit more detail in the different professions. So there's some changes in the regulations. If you have somebody in a particular profession, go back and read about their profession. One thing that's just perfectly clear, and it's a little crazy, quite frankly, is that insurance agents are able to get the 199 Cap A deduction, but a financial planner wouldn't be able to. So there are still some pure insurance agents left, and they would actually, if they made $1 million, they'd pay tax at $800,000, where a pure financial planner would pay tax on the entire million. That something doesn't seem right with that. Now, in the regulations, we have the same set of regs. Many of the major changes were in the aggregation regulations and in the regulations where they talk about how to net income. If you had three items with income and one item with a loss, how do you net those? The important thing there is a loss is a bad thing. And it's the reason it's a bad thing is because you net the loss against QBI, but you do not pull over the wage and capital from that loss. Now, more importantly, if you can't use that loss, it becomes a carry forward, but the wage and capital associated with that loss evaporate in the year that they're earned. So that's a problem. On the relevant pass-through entity side, it would pay for you to read the Dash 6 regulations. If anything that you have to read, it would be the Dash 4 and the Dash 6 regulations. I would encourage you to read both of those. More good news, the service did reevaluate their position on basis after you do a like-kind or an involuntary conversion, basically saying that your UBIA would be unadjusted. You get to keep your adjustments. Now, that also applies when you do transactions where you create a partnership or create an S corporation. On the entity aggregation side of things, we are now allowed to aggregate at a relevant pass-through entity level. So if I had a relevant pass-through entity that owned a handful of businesses and I could otherwise aggregate those, I'd be able to aggregate them. And that is meant to simplify reporting requirements. Notice 2019-07 is a very big ruling. Don't underestimate the importance of this notice. And it's going to allow aggregation for purposes of whether you have a trader business. They're going to use and this is just for real estate, okay? This is just for real estate. They call these rental real estate enterprises, or RREEs, RREEs. And relevant pass-through entities can also use the safe harbor. And these rules apply just for 199 Cap A. So when you have a RREE, basically what are we looking at? It's a interest in real property held for the production of rents, can consist of multiple properties. An individual or RPE must hold the interest directly or through a disregarded entity. Taxpayers must treat each property as a separate enterprise or treat all similar properties as separate enterprises. Commercial and residential property can't be part of the same enterprise, and you can't change the treatment from year to year. But what this does, it gets you in the game. Because unless you can rise to the level of the trader business, you can't get in the game. If you think of this 199 Cap A as an obstacle course. The first obstacle you have to get over is being a trade or business. So if you had five pieces of real estate that by themselves were not trades or businesses, this allows you to aggregate those, and then you can evaluate those in one circle for purposes of the trade or business rule. Now remember, under this notice, they specifically say real estate rented under a triple net lease is excluded from this aggregation. And that raises the question of whether a triple net lease can ever be a trade or business. Of course, no one really knows that, but it certainly seems like the service is pushing back hard on that. Now, these safe harbor requirements, separate books and records are maintained to reflect income and expenses for each property. You have to have 250 or more hours of rental services. And for taxable years beginning after 2022, 250 or more hours of rental services in any three of the five consecutive years. Looking at page 15, a taxpayer maintains contemporaneous records, time logs, or similar documents. So this is really an onerous requirement. People have a hard time keeping a mileage log, much less a log like this. And there's a description of all services performed, a description of the dates in which the services were performed, who performed the services. You are also allowed to count services of other people in meeting that 250-hour test. Now, there's an important difference. This rental services means things that a property manager would do, not things that a lawyer or an accountant or a finance expert would do. This includes advertising to rent, negotiating leases, verifying information contained in tenant applications, the collection of rent, daily operation, maintenance, and repair of property, purchase of materials, supervision of employees and independent contractors. And rental services, again, I just said this, but I'll say it again, can be performed by employees, agents, and or independent contractors. Now, rental services do not include, under this notice, financial or investment management activities, procuring property, studying or reviewing financial statements or reports on operations, managing or constructing long-term improvements, time spent traveling to and from real estate. Very, very odd. I didn't really care for that in the regs, in that if I go from building A to building B to building C to fix things, repair things, I don't understand why the travel time doesn't count. That doesn't seem that big of a requirement. Now, because certainly if a lot of times different tradesmen, when they come to fix something in your house, they're going to build in a bill for their travel time. Otherwise, no one could ever get 8 hours of work in for a day unless you're at the same site all day. Separate trades or businesses. Again, when you get into these operational rules of aggregation, an entity can conduct more than one trade or business. So if you had a dry cleaner, a bagel shop, and a tropical fish store in the same LLC, they could be miles apart, run by different staff. That's not going to be one entity. It's going to be three different entities. Generally, there must be separate activities engaged for income or profit and a complete and separate set of books. Now, you will not be considered separate if by reasons of maintaining different methods of accounting, there is a creation or shifting of profits and losses between the businesses such that income is not clearly reflected. One thing we're going to have to be very careful going forward is we do want to make sure, to the extent possible, within the four corners of the law, that we're not losing money in any particular entity. If you can avoid that by 179 or bonus elections, that's going to be smart. The regulations do clarify that qualified dividends are included in net capital gain. If you remember, when you're doing your 20% test, when you're multiplying by 20% taxable income compared to QBI, you subtract out your capital gains. So you would subtract out the qualified dividend income. What this means is that there's many clients that will be wise if they have a very large dividend portfolio and they're earning $1 million+ of dividends a year, or $500,000+ of dividends a year. They would be very, very smart to put that into a Ning. So you do have carryover rules. When you have negative total QBI after 2018, you're going to carry that forward to subsequent years, and you're going to treat it as an offset to QBI going forward. Now, that doesn't affect the deductibility of losses for other code provisions. Again, one of the biggest things we'll be up against going forward is, should we aggregate or not? That has been exponentially made more complicated by virtue of Notice 2019-7. What that notice is doing is you have to make two different aggregation decisions. Once you aggregate to get to trader business, and then once you get that far, where do you aggregate from there? So these are all going to be very difficult things. The netting rules, keep in mind, the biggest thing to pay attention to is the netting of losses. I think that's one of the bigger things. Now, one thing in the final regulations is property contributed to an S-Corp or a partnership under either 351 or 721 takes the partner or shareholder's UBIA in that property. So it takes that original amount you're going to multiply by 2.5%. Here's the rule. The old rule is if I bought something for $1,000 and I depreciate it down to $550 and then I tossed it into an S-Corp or partnership, the UBIA at the entity level would be that lower number. So it would be that lower number. It's basically kind of a disaster, if you will. Now, the most important thing is the service said after the comments came in, maybe that is right. Let's take a step back, reevaluate that, and let's let UBIA carry over when you contribute property into an entity. The same rule again applies 1031 and 1033 exchanges. Read that part of the regs if you have one of those. Great news on attribution. The final regulations have lots of examples on attribution, and they also make very clear that attribution is considered both under 267B of the code and 707B, broader than the aggregation we had before. That's very good news. Also under the final regulations, entity level aggregation. So if you have an entity that owns five subsidiary entities, the entity can aggregate those if you otherwise meet all the tests. Further good news, if you miss aggregation, you are going to be allowed that. You're going to be allowed to clean that up on an amended return. That's an awfully good thing that we have to work through. So that's something that I really want you to take a good look at, kind of a saving provision. And that's only a one-year 2018 rule. Final regulations do provide that if a relevant pastor entity fails to separately identify or report an item of QBI, W-2 wages, or UBIA of qualified property, it will presume to be zero. However, the information can be reported on an amended or late filed return for any year. The regulations also change the anti-abuse rules. This is going to have to be looked at very carefully, but it seems on the surface that they've changed under the proposed rules. They use the word significant purpose, and now they're using principal purpose. So principal seems, I think they've narrowed that a little bit. Now, also under the regulations, they are going to let you measure your threshold income. The income that you're going to compare to the threshold amount will be after distributions. We have certainly covered a lot of ground today in a short period of time. On behalf of the AICPA PFP section, this has been Bob Keebler. If you enjoyed this podcast, we highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website and access the Impact of Tax Reform Planning Toolkit. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you more about how to find these valuable resources. Thank you for being with us today.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit aicpa.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.